everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review was heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on forensics when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we've been taught from early childhood that anyone who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, "He who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client"? What if a carpenter said, "He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client"? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about lawyers. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God contract, pleading, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining. It's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we broke off, we were talking about forensics. Forensics, that's that science. That's that group of sciences, or at least it's called science, that checks the ballistics. You know, where we want to find out if it was your gun that you killed your wife with. And so we fire a bullet out of that gun into a bed of cotton, and then we recover that bullet. And then we look at the ridges and the markings on the bullet and compare it with the bullet that came out of your wife's body, and we say, aha, this is the same weapon. This is the same gun that fired the bullet that killed the victim. That's called forensics. Or where we check the DNA of somebody to find out whether or not the body fluids of somebody match with something else. There's a number of these types of things that we see, for instance, on the cop shows on television where they find the murderer by looking to science and the scientific method for finding the clues that lead us to the killer, that lead us to the criminal. But what we found here is that this thing of science, or forensics as they call it, a scientific discipline over here, is something short of science. It's not an absolute science, including fingerprints. Surprisingly, while fingerprints are pretty good identifiers, they're not absolutely foolproof, and mistakes have been made, and people have been convicted and jailed. And I pointed out to you the statistical analysis. The police actually do a pretty good job if you stop and think about them statistically. They arrest 100 people, and out of the 100 people that they arrest, 85 of them are guilty. 15 of them aren't. When we go to trial, we find that prosecutors win 94% of their cases, so we would assume that 6% of the people, that is the 15% that aren't guilty, 6% of that 15% are released, and then only 9% of people are locked up in prison who are innocent. However, we don't know that the 6% that the juries release, like an O.J. Simpson, we don't know if that 6% comes out of the 15% of innocent people or out of the 85% of guilty people. Because if it comes out of the 85% of guilty people, that takes us down to 79 and 21. And 21% is just about where we find the number of people who have been convicted wrongly and then released, and then we found out that, oops, the forensics or something else. It isn't always forensic. Sometimes it's some other cause that causes somebody to be convicted, and we find out later that they were innocent. But it's around 25%. Now, in rape cases, just taking this one crime of rape, since DNA came on the scene, we found that fully 30% of the people in prison who have been convicted for rape have been convicted improperly. They are actually innocent. Now, that's not you know, a big number, because most people are not in jail for rape. Most people are in jail for drug offenses. And, you know, by and large, those people are actually guilty of the charges that have been brought against them, and that's not a big deal. But there are other people who have been convicted for other crimes, and the forensics, that is, the fingerprints, as we pointed out to you last time, were incorrect. And in some cases, it's not just the say-so of one guy, it's the say-so of four guys that made the same mistake on the same case. And what this illustrates to us is that science, as good as it is not perfect, and a lot of times they make mistakes. And sometimes it's not the science that's at fault, it's the scientist that is at fault. It's the analyst. And for some reason, he phonies up, and he comes in and testifies falsely against somebody and convicts this guy. The jury didn't get all the facts, or they got the wrong facts, and they came to the wrong conclusion because of the testimony of the forensics expert. And we found one guy in the last program, or the last two programs, that the Supreme Court of West Virginia overturned every conviction that has ever been involved with this one particular analyst, this one particular forensics expert. He was so bad, he came in and testified and would lie and tell whatever story needed to be told to convict anybody that was on trial. And of course, when they found out about that, they corrected it. But it doesn't do much for the thousands of people who are actually locked up in prison today, who would like to be released from prison because they're actually innocent. So let's take a look here at another part of the story. What happens when you actually are convicted and you find out, or you're able to show or prove that you're actually innocent? Is there any way that you can get compensated for the years in prison? The answer to that is yes. Yes. And that's another reason why states and prosecutors and judges and courts do not want to look very deep at wrongful convictions. Because If we took all of the rape people, all the rape victims that have been unjustly convicted and incarcerated, and they're just as much a victim now as the rape victim herself, it could bankrupt some states. Because here's an example of this, and I can't show you hundreds, but I'll show you one or two. Here's a story of a man who collected $9 million for 11 years in prison. Now, would you spend 11 years in prison to get $9 million? I don't think I would want to do that even for $9 million. The city of Chicago announced Friday that it would pay $9 million to settle a lawsuit brought by a man wrongfully convicted of rape and will open an investigation into the police officers and crime lab analysts who handled the case. Chicago Police Superintendent Philip Klein and City Corporation Counsel Mara Georges said that they would investigate the crime lab analysts and five detectives who handled the case and of LaFonso Rollins, who was said to have confessed to raping an elderly woman. Now, Rollins spent 11 years in prison before being exonerated in 2004 by DNA testing. The decision to settle the case and launch the investigation was an abrupt turnaround by officials prompted by the discovery of documents damaging to the city's case. The documents were in the possession of a former crime lab analyst who now works for the Michigan State Police Crime Laboratory. The issue of police obtaining false confessions from innocent suspects as well as shoddy crime lab work have dogged Chicago police in other cases in recent years, and they have resulted in multi-million dollar settlements of lawsuits brought by other wrongly convicted defendants. Now, I want to point out to you that we know statistically that 15% of the prison population, let me show you how many people that is. In America today, we have 2 million people locked up in our prisons. We have more people locked up in our prisons than any other nation in the world per capita. That includes China and Russia, the two super police states. So America is actually the world's number one police state. Now, let's just multiply that times 0.15, and that tells us that there are 300,000 prisoners locked up in America. That's a pretty good-sized city. It's like taking a city like Boise, Idaho, for instance. I don't know if Boise has 300,000 people, but let's just take the capital city of Idaho, Boise, Idaho, and lock everybody up in prison. And they're all innocent. Now, that's pretty telling, and it's pretty significant. Just take your town. You know how many people live in your town? 30,000? Well, let's just take 10 cities like yours at 30,000 people. That'd be about like Eureka, California. And let's take 10 of those cities, take everybody in the city and lock them up. And they're all innocent. That's pretty significant. Now, if we were to pay each one of those 300,000 victims, that's 300,000 times 9 million, we would have $2,700 million. $2,700 million. That'd be $2,700 million, I guess, wouldn't it? Now, that's what we know about. I say that's pretty significant. Now, the issue of the police obtaining false confessions from innocent suspects, as well as shoddy crime lab work, have dogged Chicago police in other cases in recent years. So this case is not of and by itself, just in Chicago. In fact, Chicago has many of these cases that have been uncovered, and you can see the logic behind the city council and the mayor and the chief of police. They don't want to find any of those cases because they have to pay off when they find them. So there's nobody in official circles who are interested in finding these 300,000 wrongfully convicted people. Now, it's easy enough to shrug it off, but picture yourself being jailed for life or 20, 30, 40 years for rape or murder or something, and you're innocent. And there's no way for you to prove it, and there's no one looking for the truth. No one is looking for the truth. And that's why you don't find very many of these 300,000 people. Now, in announcing the settlement, Georgia said that the city recently learned that there might have been a problem with how the old Chicago crime lab handled the case, referring to the lab that in 1996 was taken over by the Illinois State Police. City officials declined to say specifically what the problem was. All right. Now, City officials are saying then, in effect, we're not going to tell you what the problem was, because if we did that, thousands of other people who have been wrongfully convicted out of the same crime lab would then have something to go on so that they could be released from prison. So the official position is, we do not want any innocent people locked up in jail to find out how it is that we discovered, or how this prisoner discovered the flaw or the fatal mistake in his case. Because that might lead to other people finding the flaw in their case, which would then open the floodgates to more and more lawsuits for more and more people that have been wrongfully convicted. What a commentary on America. We lock people up that are innocent, 300,000 of them that we know of, statistically, and then we close the door so that they can never find, can never get the evidence that they need to prove their innocence. Isn't that just real special? Now, that's America, boys and girls. That's not Russia or China now. We're not talking about some police state like North Korea. We know they're bad. But we would like to think of ourselves as being something better than that, wouldn't we? Now, Robert Fioretti, a lawyer for Rollins, said in a separate news conference Friday that at the time of Rollins' arrest, a blood sample was taken from Rollins to compare with evidence found at the scene of the rape, Floretti said. And either they did not run it, or if they did, they did not disclose the results. When asked if the document showed that the crime lab tests had excluded Rollins as a suspect before he was convicted, Jennifer Hoyle, a spokeswoman for the Corporation Counsel, declined to answer. All right, now, when you're asked this question, did the evidence that the crime lab had at the time in 1996, did it disclose that this man was actually innocent? And they refused to answer. Well, then it's pretty obvious that yes, it did. The crime lab, the prosecuting attorney, and the police all knew that the guy was innocent. And they convicted an innocent man, and they knew he was innocent when they convicted him. Now, how often does that happen? Well, I don't have any real hard numbers on that, but it happens more frequently than we would like to admit. And that's because, let's suppose that this guy who was convicted here, let's suppose he actually is a bad guy. Let's suppose he's, you know, he's got a criminal record behind him. And the police know that this guy's a bad guy to start with. It's kind of like that Rodney King fella out there in California some years back that the police got caught on videotape beating. And we know he's a bad guy, and we don't deny that the guy is a bad guy. But is that an excuse then that we should use, because he is a bad guy, to convict him for a rape that he didn't commit and then lock him up for life in prison or something? Is that part of the American scene? Is that part and parcel with what you want to be involved in? Because I don't want to be involved in that. I'd like you to count me out. It's like that Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, or putting hoods on people, you know, like our army does over there, and hauling these people in. I mean, if you want to know why the people of Iraq, 80% of the people of Iraq want us out of there, it's because of our conduct and our behavior. Just take a look at the conduct and behavior of the military, that is the American military in Baghdad, and put yourself on the other side of the coin and say to yourself, if a foreign occupying power were here in the United States treating us the way we're treating those Iraqis, would we want them here in our country? You know, it's just a matter of, walk a mile in the other guy's moccasin and then ask the question. We never treated German prisoners like that in World War II. Now, I'm sure that there were a lot of atrocities committed in World War II by our guys over in Germany. But we weren't parading people around, torturing them and killing them in prison. And if it occurred from time to time. It was an anomaly. What's going on in Iraq is systemic. It goes on day in and day out. Hell, these guys have been doing this for 3.5 years now. And it doesn't just go on in Iraq. It goes on right here in downtown Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. The black people of America are not complaining about police abuse. As I speak to you right now, there's a big news story in the news, and this ought to bring a little remembrance to you, spark your memory. New York City, the police killed one man and shot two others in a hail of bullets. 50 shots fired at three guys that were unarmed. Now, how in the hell does that happen? You know, I'm a white guy. You know, I got to shake my head when I see that kind of crap. And the mayor of the city of New York, you know, Bloomberg, nice guy, I'm sure. He tried to put the best face forward, you know, and appear to be uninvolved and just an innocent bystander who's, well, let's put an investigation together and let's figure out what actually happened here. Hey, listen, when you get three black guys at 2 o'clock in the morning that come out of a bar and they're unarmed and the police shoot 50 shots at them, you know, it takes a minute or two to fire off 50 rounds, even if there's five cops firing them. And surely the cops must have woke up to the fact that nobody was shooting at them. 50 shots? I mean, you know, I'm just a Joe Sixpack over here, but I'm not brain dead yet. And, you know, black people, you know, they get a little uptight when that happens to them. They're getting singled out, and I don't know how many black cops there were in these five here, but, you know, it doesn't take you very long to figure out that we've zeroed in on a group of people over here called blacks, and we don't like them very well, and so we're going to shoot them. The same thing is true over in Iraq. You know, our guys over there don't like what's going on in Iraq, and so they're going to teach them Iraqis a thing or two. Well, okay, but what goes around comes around. What goes around comes around. And this goes on here in America, and the conviction here, and this is what we're concerned about this week in bringing this to your attention, is that you got 300,000 people, and that's what we know about. That's what we admit to. It's kind of like the story I brought to you not too far back. We're talking about iatrogenic disease, the disease that is caused by, or the maladies caused by doctors in their clinics and hospitals. Now, doctors, these are licensed, professional medical doctors kill 130,000 people a year by prescribing the wrong medicines or prescribing too much or not enough of that medicine. And that's just the drug deaths that come from iatrogenic disease. I saw a number the other day that was pretty shocking. Hospitals now and clinics kill an additional 90,000 people. In addition to that, so that's 90,000 plus 130,000. That looks to me like about a million two. Excuse me, 220,000. Not a million two, but 220,000. And that's what they're admitting to. See my point? You know it's worse than that, but, you know, we don't know how much worse than that it is. Well, if you look at iatrogenic disease and then the number of people killed by hospitals and doctors, or hospitals and clinics, in addition to the doctors, and you come up to 200,000 a year. My God, kids, we're only killing less than 50,000 people here in auto accidents. We kill four times as many in the hospital. A hospital or a doctor's visit is four times more likely to get you killed than an automobile. It's four times more dangerous to go to a doctor or a hospital than it is to drive your car. Now take a look at the number of people that are involved in Iraq. And every day, you know, two or three Americans are getting killed. You know, if you worked out the numbers on this, going to your doctor or hospital is probably 10 times more likely to get you killed, or 20 times or 50 times more likely to get you killed than going out on patrol in Baghdad. And that's what goes on right here in downtown Chicago, for crying out loud. Now, Klein and the police department would focus on whether the crime lab handled evidence in the case properly and also on the conduct of the detectives in the case. Well, in the O.J. Simpson case, Mark Furman lied about his testimony concerning O.J. Simpson. Do police lie when they come into court and testify against somebody? They lie constantly. In fact, I'll tell you the truth from my perspective, from my own personal experience. Now, I've been in trial court situations as a defendant many, many times over. I'm a civil rights investigator. I'm a civil rights litigator. And I have done many civil rights cases. And I have ferreted out police who have abused their powers and their authority. And I have brought them to trial many, many times. And in all of the years, and I've been doing this now since 1981, since November of 1981. Let's see, how long is that? 91, 101, 106, that's 25 years. God, time flies when you're having fun. I've been at this for 25 years, and in 25 years, I have probably faced 50 policemen, 50 or more, maybe 100 or more, but 50. I'm going to pick a number here, 50, at least 50. And in my experience, I've only seen one policeman who got on the witness stand and told the truth about me and my case. One time out of that 50. And I'll tell you what his name is. His name was John DeLeonard. That was the only policeman that I ever saw tell the truth about me or my case when I had him on the witness stand. Now, I don't know if the police lie about everybody the way they lied about me, but I'm just reporting the facts, lady, and I've been in this business now for 25 years. I'm pretty active at it. You know, I've been out here after bad policemen, you know, for many, many years. Those 15 or 16 cops that beat up on Rodney King out there, the guy was black, and he was a bad guy, and they decided to hold curbstone court. That's what we call that, curbstone court. We'll just take care of this trial right here. We used to call this a lynch, or lynch mob, you know, in times past, and that's a bad practice also, these lynch mobs. We don't have those so much anymore as we used to have in the old days. But we still have these rogue cops running around. And I don't know how many there are. I'm not here to shake down the cops and be critical. And out of New York City, I mean, you've probably got, 7,000 police in New York City, or maybe it's more than that, I don't know, but 7,000 at least. And how many cops would be involved in a shooting like that one I just described to you that's in the news today? I can't tell you that either. It's a minority. It's not very many. Not very many. And most police don't behave like that. And I don't want to leave you with a bad impression here. Most policemen don't do that. And most of the cops that I've come in contact with, you know, over the years have been pretty decent people. Judges are pretty decent people. Hell, even the prosecutors are fair to middling decent people. What is it that makes these people behave the way they do? What made our people behave the way they did at Abu Ghraib? Is it Rumsfeld? Is it Bush? Is it Cheney? You know, there's got to be some reason for doing this. We didn't do it in World War II. We didn't do it in Korea. We didn't do it in Vietnam. We didn't do it in the Spanish-American War or World War I. Or the Civil War. I mean, we've been involved in some pretty bloody conflicts, we Americans have, and we weren't out here torturing people, putting hoods over the top of their heads and shooting women and children, raping them the way we're doing here in Iraq. What's changed? What's different? And we weren't always locking people up in America. We used to have a concept in this country. We would rather turn a guilty man loose than to arrest and jail an innocent man, but it's changed now. Our adversarial system has now replaced our old justice system. We have now turned from the Ten Commandments and the justice or righteousness to a system now of the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto and an adversarial system. And I guess for some reason we seem to think this is pretty good, unless, of course, you get caught up in the system. You know, if this happens to you and you get locked up and you're innocent, how's that going to make you feel? Now, this fellow Fioretti said the prosecution of Rollins was marred by improper police lineups, shoddy crime lab work, and coerced false confessions. Now, these are three illegal activities. You know, it's against the law for you to put in a police lineup and do it improperly, or to use shoddy crime lab work, or coerce false confessions. It's against the law to do that. Police do it all the time. You know, they do it 300,000 times that we know of, for crying out loud. That's the way you get 300,000 people locked up in prison that are innocent. The case stinks at every level. He said it's time for the city to take a hard look at its crime lab. Now, Rollins filed a $10 million civil rights lawsuit last April alleging that Chicago detectives obtained his confession through threats and coercion. And since then, the city had been offering $3 million, but Rollins' lawyers had refused to budge from the demand of $9 million. Well, good for them. In fact, I think if they'd have stuck with their original $10 million and collected it, if I'd have been sitting on the jury, I would have suggested more. I don't think $1 million a year is enough for 11 years in prison. I know $9 million isn't, and I'm not sure that $1 million a year would be the right number, especially in today's inflated dollars, because they're only worth about $100,000 of real money, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Fioretti discussed or described Friday how the city suddenly changed its position. On Wednesday, Mara Georges called at 4:10 p.m. and Fioretti said she wanted to discuss settlement. She said, "We've got documents that are pretty bad." Fioretti said Georges met with him and co-counsel Lonnie Ogus shortly afterward, and he said that Georges noted that Rollins' lawyer had sought to take the deposition of Joel Schultz, a Chicago police crime lab analyst who had worked on Rollins' case before it came to trial in 1993. City attorneys had re-interviewed Schultz first, however, and Fioretti said Georges told him, "We found out he has documents, and these documents are pretty damning, and you will call, and you'll call an immediate press conference after you see them." Georges upped the city's offer to $6 million. Fioretti said that we said we were sticking with $9 million, and that's what happened. They agreed to $6 million now and another $3 million in January of 2007. Hoyle said Georges would not comment on Fioretti's account because she considers the conversation private. Hoyle added, and in terms of Mara's conversation with him, some of the remarks being attributed to Mara, that's not true. She did not say that they would call a press conference. Well, I'm just going to pause right there. The rest of the article gets a little bit redundant, but let's take a look at the settlement here. The city offered $3 million. They got sued for 10, they offered 3, that's very common. Then they come back and they find some damning material. Material that shows that they were negligent and that they were in fact guilty. It's so bad that it showed that they deliberately forced a confession out of this guy, used it against him. They knew from the blood samples that he was innocent, and they deliberately convicted an innocent man. That's the police and the crime lab working together with the prosecutor. And then when this thing was going into deposition, they could actually prove with documentation that this had occurred. How often does that occur? I don't think anybody can say with specificity. It's a miracle when we find one guy out of 300,000 that's innocent and we can actually show that he was wrongfully convicted. That's a miracle by itself. How many more than the 300,000 that we know about? You know, that's anybody's guess. Typically, when you find something that's wrong, then you can quantify it. If you take that wrong and you double it, you'll probably be about correct. About correct. Now, that's what we've discovered in the past in other areas. My guess would be here that it's probably more like 600,000. It's probably twice as bad. We did that with iatrogenic disease. You know, different authorities have different numbers, and so I always like to take the low number, the ones that they admit to, and then just extrapolate those out and say, well, what do you think of that? This is the low-end number, 300,000. You know, well, what do you think of that? And the numbers are actually much worse. So the answer to the question that I asked at the beginning of the program is, how many of these cases are there? Well, there's so many of these cases that the city won't comment. They won't tell any more information. This guy got some real dirt on the city. But this dirt is not going to be made public. This settlement, when it's made out of court like this, they require that you keep quiet. And if you divulge the amount, which in this case we see the amount, but most times you can't even know what the amount of the settlement is or what the terms and conditions of the settlement. And the reason for the out-of-court settlement is so that none of this becomes public. The city is willing to pay $9 million of taxpayer money to keep this quiet. Frankly, I believe this should be shouted from the rooftops. That's my opinion of it. But it isn't, and it won't be, and that will protect all of you taxpayers so that you can keep those other 299,999 men and women in prison, locked up, who are innocent, and you won't have to pay them. I don't know which crime was worse, that is the criminal committing the crime, or the police and the public officials over here that lock up innocent people. All right, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet and daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law School teaches 8 schools, including family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. I might say here also that here at the law school, we teach people these 28 principles or 28 things that you need to know to make sure that this false conviction doesn't happen to you, which is another reason for bringing to your attention forensics, and that this forensic evidence that's being used against people is it's good. And I'm not complaining, and I'm not saying that we can't identify bullets that are fired from the same gun and so on, or that we can't identify body fluids and hairs and things like that. And that in most cases, I will concede that in most cases, the forensic labs are doing their work and they're doing a good job. It's in that 15% of the cases where they're doing a bad job or they're falsifying the evidence. And that alerts every trial lawyer. You know, if you're a trial lawyer and you listen to this program and you say, well, this guy's some kind of a kook over here. We all know that fingerprints are infallible. I've already showed you they're not infallible. They're good, but they're not infallible. And the same thing is true with the evidence that comes out of the crime lab. And why don't you have your own crime lab? If you're representing some guy and he maintains that he's really innocent and he didn't do this, and if you are innocent, don't confess to something you didn't do. Don't confess to something you did not do. And if you have confessed, as soon as you can get away from the police or you get into the trial court, say they beat the hell out of me and forced me to confess, and they said that if I came into court and testified, they'd kill me. And I'm afraid for my life, and I need the witness protection program, because I'm going to tell you that that guy over there just beat the holy living hell out of me. And yes, I confessed, and you would have confessed too if they'd have twisted your arm behind your back or bent your fingers around backwards. And then somebody said, this actually happened to me one time, a guy by the name of Larry Richards. God bless old Larry Richards, up in the Ada County Jail. He said to the six guys standing there, he says, don't make any marks on him. Let me tell you, boys and girls, I hurt bad for 2 weeks and there were no marks on me. So if you don't think that the police can force a confession out of you, let me assure you, from personal experience, you will tell the police anything they want to hear from your lips. When the pain, this is called pain compliance here in America. See, we don't use torture in America. We use pain compliance. They just apply enough pain to you until you comply. And they're so good at it, they won't even bruise you. And when they get through, I'm telling you, you're going to hurt bad for about 1 week. And in some cases, you may be hurting pretty bad for 2 weeks. And no marks, no blood, no bruises. I'm telling you, these boys are good. Now, this is the danger of false confessions. And so when I hear somebody confess to something over here, I take it with a grain of salt. If I was sitting on a jury and somebody said, I got this guy's confession. And then the trial lawyers always keep their clients off the witness stand. You never hear the defendant, you know, get on the witness stand and say, well, here's my side of the story. And let me tell you, boys and girls, if you're innocent, you have to get on the witness stand and tell your side of the story. It's just that simple. And undergo cross-examination. And if you knew and understood cross-examination, you could get on the witness stand and tell your story and withstand cross-examination. So if you are locked up in prison, we get a lot of calls here at the law school, a lot of letters, not calls, but a lot of letters here from prisoners who are actually locked up in jail. And they'll write me a letter and they'll say, well, Mr. Gordon, I'm really innocent and I need to prove that and I need your help. Would you do that for me? You know, it's kind of like driving up to the McDonald's drive-up window. I'm hungry, and so will you cook me a hamburger and fries and do all this for me? And the answer is, no, I won't. No, I won't. I don't have enough time. There's not enough years left in my lifespan over here to take up the crusade like 60 minutes or 20-20 to do all that work. But we do operate a law school, and we can teach you how to do it, or we can teach your mother or brother or somebody else that's on the outside how to do this. I mean, if you want to learn how to get the evidence, you know, or how to get a new trial, or if you want to work on getting yourself extricated from prison, you know, there's a methodology that's available to do that. And there are some lawyers that actually do that. Barry Scheck does that. And there are a lot of lawyers that do that, but you got to understand that once you're convicted, it is 10, 20, maybe 30 or 50 times harder now to prove you're innocent than it is when we're going to trial for the first time. If a man is really innocent, he should be able to come into trial and prove that he's innocent right in front of the jury. Unfortunately, a lot of trial lawyers are unable to do that. Now, let me take a look here at the second story I wanted to bring you today. It's a crime when science gets it wrong. Now, here's a test that I want you to take. I'm going to give you a test now. Here's an analysis that was done of 86 criminal convictions that DNA evidence later found to be wrong. 86 convictions here, nearly 100. Please rank the factors most often found to have contributed to the wrongful convictions. And here's the list. Incompetent defense lawyers, police misconduct, eyewitness errors, false testimony by forensic scientists, prosecutorial misconduct, false confessions, errors in scientific testing, false testimony by lay witnesses, and dishonest informants. Now there's 9 causes that are listed here. I'll read those to you again. 9 causes of wrongful convictions. That is, was it an incompetent defense lawyer? Was it police misconduct, eyewitness errors, false testimony by forensic scientists, prosecutorial misconduct, false confessions, errors in scientific testing, false testimony by lay witnesses, or dishonest informants. 9 causes for wrongful convictions. Now, if you ranked these false confessions last, you are right. But did you guess 17% of the cases, nearly 1 in 5, featured false confessions? That percentage tied with false testimony by lay witnesses. So, false confessions then represents 17% of the wrongful convictions. And it's tied with false testimony by lay witnesses. That's the lady who says, "That's the man that raped me right there." Now, I've done a couple of stories on Professor Swift's experiments back in 1918. The least reliable evidence that ever comes into court comes from witnesses, eyewitness testimony. So the next time the police have a lineup and they're saying to you, lady, we think it's that guy there, number 4. Isn't that the guy that raped you? What they're doing is they're using the power of suggestion to suggest to you that they believe it's number 4. They have already singled out number 4. And they need you, the lay witness, the traumatized victim of the rape, to convict that number 4. And your testimony is going to do that. And 30% of the convictions for rape are false. And it comes from these eyewitnesses who are lay witnesses. All right, now if you ranked eyewitness error first, you were also right. Erroneous eyewitness accounts showed up in a stunning 71% of these cases. Eyewitnesses who are identifying this guy or whoever the defendant is are incorrect 71% of the time. And it causes 71% of these convictions. Now, the most important finding, prosecutors will be glad to know that their brothers and sisters engaged in misconduct in fewer of these cases, 28%, than police officers, 44%. So in 44% of the cases, nearly half, the police officers engaged in misconduct. And prosecutors are engaged in 28% of these cases, misconduct. So, one prosecutor out of 4 is engaged in misconduct. Now, if he's engaged in misconduct in these cases that we've been able to identify, you can rest assured that 28% of the prosecutors, 28% of the cases, whether the guy is rightfully convicted or wrongfully convicted, are engaging in misconduct. Why can't we have prosecutors that come into court and play the game by the rules? 100% of the time. After all prosecutors have law degrees. All prosecutors go to law school. All prosecutors know what the rules are. All prosecutors are paid professionals. And there isn't a single one of those prosecutors that has anything to lose by going in there and playing the game according to the rules. And if we all did that, there wouldn't be any false confessions. Because prosecutors would make sure that the confession is true, accurate, and correct, or he would not use it as evidence against the defendant. The police, you know, they're also professionals. Do you know that policemen go to school to learn to be policemen? They go through training programs. Policemen know the rules. Policemen are paid professionals. And the policeman knows what the rules are, and he knows when he is coercing. He knows when he's using the power of suggestion against a traumatized rape victim in order to pin this rap or pin this case on somebody that he knows is innocent. He knows that. Policemen and prosecutors, ladies and gentlemen, are not ignorant people. They're trained. They're professional. They know what they're doing. And the 300,000 people that are being locked up in prison falsely, these people that are putting them in prison, they know what they're doing. That's the tragedy of it. That's the crime involved here. That's why I showed you here. The city is going to pay $9 million for this false jailing because they got caught with their hand in the cookie jar. In most cases, the police, prosecutors, and crime lab people are able to cover up their crimes. You're not going to catch prosecutors and police in most cases. They're professionals. They're going to convict you and they're going to get away with it. It's a crime that's being committed 300,000 times in our prison population. Again, it's not the majority. You know, if you take 300,000, we're talking about 15%. But I contend that that's 15% more than needs to be there. It's lamentable if there was one person out of 2 million that was locked up that was innocent. That would be lamentable. But it would be acceptable. I mean, we're not going to get it right 100% of the time. But I don't think we need to be wrong 15%. 15 is, in my view, totally unacceptable. Now, the other is the most important thing in the study now. And I was most surprised by two findings. One is that incompetent defense lawyers figured in just 19%. So in one case out of five, it was an incompetent defense lawyer. And I think that's tragic because defense lawyers are also paid professionals. And I know Jerry Spence in his book With Justice for None pointed this out very, very poignantly. He said that the trial lawyers that he trains, and he operates a law school also, just for your information. Jerry Spence is probably one of the top trial lawyers in America. He's the guy that defended this case. I'm trying to think of this guy's name up in Boise, Idaho. The guy's name slips my mind now. Very famous guy. Anyway, this guy was falsely accused here of being a terrorist of his time back in the 1980s. And it was a setup deal, and his wife and baby were, his wife was killed, and his son was killed. His wife and son was killed here in northern Idaho. And Jerry Spence is the guy that came down there and defended him. Now, once in a while, there's a top-rated lawyer, you know, like a Barry Scheck or an Alan Dershowitz or a Jerry Spence that'll take on a case like this and go in there and go to bat for somebody and win his case. That's very rare. Of course, that's very rare. But the point is that defense lawyers, 19% of the time, figure in the loss of a case where a guy is innocent, and the defense lawyer, who's also a paid professional, should have been in there questioning the crime lab, questioning the police, cross-examining witnesses, and proving that his client was in fact innocent. And Jerry Spence said that it's lamentable that most of the trial lawyers that he comes in contact with in his seminars and in his law school are so incompetent that they are unable to carry on or carry out a simple cross-examination. Now, you'll remember at the beginning of the program, I told you a story about James Nielsen, a professor at the Hastings Law School. And he said it's a fact that a student can graduate from the fourth largest law school in the United States without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. Children, this is the equivalent, as Jerry Spence points out, as a doctor examining your tonsils. I mean, that's how rudimentary those things are. And he says, you know, you get most of these people coming out of the fourth largest law school. If this is the fourth largest law school in the country, what do you think the rest of them are doing? So the defense lawyers are incompetent in one case out of five, or they figure in this conviction of innocent people about 20% of the time. And then it goes on over here. The percentages exceed 100% because more than one factor was found in many of these cases. But time after time, juries believed experts in ballistics, experts in fingerprint identification, the experts in hair analysis and other forensic disciplines who were wrong or who were lying or who were both lying and wrong. Now, in the medical area, we find this. The doctor takes a blood test. And they send it off to the lab. And it comes back and they say, oh my God, you've got cancer. And 50% of the time, the lab was wrong in their analysis. 50%. Hell, I can do that good flipping a coin. You know, the next time you go to your doctor's office, and you get a laboratory report, you know, the doctor says, well, let's perform this test. And you say, well, what's this test going to cost? And he says, well, the test is going to cost $500, and we're going to test and find out whether you got cancer or not. And so you pay the $500, and you send off the samples, and it comes back from the lab. And they say to you, well, you don't have cancer. And then later on it turns out, well, yes, indeed, you did have cancer. And they didn't find it last year because the lab made a mistake. Or they'll send you back the report, and then you've got cancer. And so the doctor says, well, that's what I thought, so we're going to lop off your left breast. How many breasts have been amputated because of faulty or bad laboratory results? The answer is 50%. Half of them are incorrect. Now, this is why the medical profession has come up with the conclusion that, hey, we need to have a second opinion. What we need to do here is to go to another doctor and have another test done. And if you'll have three tests, you know, before I had my left breast cut off, ladies, I would have three tests. I would pay $500 to three laboratories to get three reports. And when I got three reports back that said, your left breast is malignant, your left breast is malignant, your left breast is malignant. If I got three reports back from three laboratories, from three separate doctors who all concluded that you have a malignant tumor in your left breast, I still wouldn't have it cut off, but then that's just me. I'd go with alternative therapy. But in any event, at that point in time, you could rest assured that you do have cancer in your left breast. And I would say that it's worth $1,500, $500 and three tests to come to the right conclusion. It's tragic, I think, that you have to go to three specialist to find something out like that. But hey, listen, this laboratory analysis is not an exact science. It is the reading of, it is the opinion of, it is the skill and the expertise of the analyst. And different analysts have different skills, different expertise. They're not all the same. And that's what we're finding out here in the crime lab. Remember, the laboratory is scientific, and the laboratory is where we go to practice science. It isn't exact, because if it was exact, we wouldn't be practicing. That's why we call them medical practitioners. They are practicing medicine on you. And it takes practice to make perfect. They're not always right. And the tragedy is that these same laboratories, or laboratories that are very similar, make these kinds of mistakes that lock people up in prison. And that's the point of our story. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.